Maslan Idris was a rising star in Malaysian politics and was looking for a way to climb the ladder even faster. He hired a well-known spiritual guru, aka a witch doctor, known as Mona Fandy, to help aid him in his quest. However, while she promised him the moon and charged him for all the stars in the sky, Mona failed to help Maslan reach his goal. In fact, Mona ended up being charged for his murder. What exactly happened when Mona began working for Maslan?
Killing. Missing. Hidden. A podcast about bad things.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to yet another episode of Killing, Missing, Hidden, one of your favorite podcasts. I don't know if you knew that, but we held this vote. You weren't there, but we all decided that you really enjoy listening to this podcast. I'm Brad, your fearless host, because I'm told that I need to periodically remind you people why I'm worth listening to. I'm a former criminal defense trial attorney. I represented folks in everything from DUIs, sexual abuse, to murder. These days, I work as a government drone, as 10 years of trial work kind of wore me out and kept me away from my family a bit too much. So now I just push papers for a living. If you're new here, we focus on weird murders, missing persons cases, and then just weird stuff beyond that. Like last week's episode, which is great, by the way. And the Patreon follow-up rocked too. It was a fun one. But this one's fun too. I mean, as fun as murders can go, right? All right. I will apologize ahead of time. I've got a cold. I've put off recording this episode as long as I could in the hopes I would get better. Instead, I just sound more gross. So please bear with me as I work my way through this episode. All right. We have the reverse mullet rule here, right? Fun stuff up front, business at the back. So we're just going to jump in today's wicked little episode. So like I said, this week we're traveling over to Malaysia, a fun little country. I don't know that we've been there before. And this is the story of Mazna Ismail. Mazna was born on January 1st, 1956. And from a very early age, it was clear that she was meant for stardom. She was an avid dancer and singer and actually secured a gig as a water ballet dancer during her youth. I have no idea what that is, but it sounds like something that is not for Brad. But I'm sure the people of Malaysia enjoyed it very much. Yet, Mazna's true passion was singing, and she felt like it was her goal in life to become Malaysia's greatest pop star ever. She struggled to break into the entertainment industry, as we all do. But as she struggled, she met and fell in love with a fellow by the name of Muhammad Nur Adadi Abdul Rahman, who claimed to be her biggest fan. He vowed to do everything he could to make her a pop star of legendary status. And he was serious about this, like, he had his own money, I never figured out what from, and he used that money to help her self-publish her very first album. Now, together, they decided that Mazna needed a stage name to boost her popularity. And so she took on the moniker of Mona Fandy. And that's what we will refer to her as. Muhammad, as her de facto manager, worked tirelessly to get Mona in front of the world. And he was, moderately successful at it, better than I could do, for sure. He managed to get her several appearances on TV where she could perform. But sadly, despite several years of hard work and untold amounts of money being thrown at this career path, Mona kind of decided that she just wasn't destined to be a pop star. But she was destined to be a star. She just needed a career change. And the most natural change from being a pop star is, of course, to move into witchcraft. All right, so we're instantly going to make this podcast story about me, because it's my show and I need all the attention. I may have told this story on the podcast before, but I'm going to have to tell it again or I won't be able to live with myself. When I was in practice, I had this Hispanic fellow come in to make an appointment. All right, well, in fairness, he met with my partner, but the story sounds better if I tell it like I was involved because, again, my podcast, right? So this Hispanic gentleman comes in. Let's give him a name. What's a good name? Let's go with Javier. That sounds pretty cool. And he claimed on the phone that he wanted to sue someone because he hired him and he didn't perform the services. And, you know, normally we wouldn't consider this type of case, but we were talking like 25 grand. So we thought, let's at least hear him out and see what he has to say. So, you know, he comes in and we talk to him and we get his story, and he can't tell us the whole story without giving us some context. And that context is, you know, he's a hardworking man. He supports his wife and his kids. He's the sole breadwinner. And, you know, sometimes he just needs to go out with the boys, right? And in his world, going out with the boys meant going out to some of the local clubs. And the thing you have to know, at least in our area, and I assume this is a cultural thing, not just an Alabama thing, but at least in our area, the Hispanic nightclubs are full of women who make a living at this place. You know, some are, of course, glorified prostitutes. Others just kind of dabble in the arts of temptation. So what the bulk of these women do is they hang out at the bar, wait for men to come in, and then they go up and flirt with them, sit on their laps, bring them drinks, stuff like that. And then they, you know, charge them to dance with them. And, you know, it's not much. It's I've never been, but I think it's something like $5 per dance. And, you know, if you're really well off or really good looking, maybe you can buddy up with her in the shadows and do some necking. That's the oldest sounding word I could find for that activity. And, you know, there'd be an additional charge for that. And of course, the more you drink and the drunker you get, then all of a sudden the prices start going up a little and you start getting charged for dances you don't remember. And then on top of that, you know, a lot of these women aren't exactly beauty queens. You know, one that I remember representing kind of looked like a chupacabra with a bad case of herpes. But she would make like hundreds of dollars of cash in a night from doing this. So it's a good way to make a living. And she wasn't one of the prostitute ones. She was just one of the dancing ones. Well, you know, Javier's wife didn't really like going out. She wouldn't stay home with the kids. She was a home buddy and all that. So he would go out and drink and dance and spend a little bit too much money, which his wife kind of hated at first. And like most Hispanic women, she wasn't bashful about sharing her opinion on this matter. And, you know, soon this became an issue in the marriage, and then it kind of came to a head, and Javier learned that the wife was, let's say, dancing with her own side piece. Huge fight follows. She moves out, takes the kids. He tries calling her and tries to make peace, but she won't take his phone calls. And I mean, and to Javier's credit, despite him kind of acting crappy, he really did love his wife and he really did love his kids. He didn't see this as cheating. This was just something you did with the boys, I guess. So, you know, at this point, what would you do if you were Javier? Maybe hire a divorce attorney to help protect your rights to see your kids. Perhaps, you know, schedule some counseling so you can get your marriage back on track and improve the communication. Maybe you bury her in flowers and love notes and teddy bears. Or maybe you do what Javier did. My English came out. And you hire a witch doctor. That's right. Javier, who is not a man of great means, hires the most famous and powerful witch doctor in all of central Alabama. And he wants this dude to use his dark arts to win back the love of his life. Exchange for this, like I said, he was charged a nominal fee of $25,000. Javier came to see us to see if he could sue the witch doctor because the magic spell didn't work to win back his wife. Ultimately, we kind of turned down Javier's case because, you know, we explained that an American jury is not really going to understand this. They won't really feel a whole lot of sympathy for how he lost his money. They'd view it more as like a stupid tax. And, you know, legally it would be hard to win too because the witch doctor's argument would be, I didn't promise that his wife would come back. I just promised to perform the spell. So I'm sure he danced around like a monkey and, you know, maybe even slaughtered a chicken on his behalf. And, you know, plus we kind of didn't want to take the case because, you know, we didn't want to be turned into a frog or wake up with a tail because we upset the wrong witch doctor. But to me, the takeaway from this story is, oh my God, how much money do witch doctors make? I mean, he talked this dude, a construction worker, right, who lives in a trailer and, you know, supports a family on this one income. He talked him into shelling out $25,000 in cash. I mean, I can't get people who were in jail to shell out that kind of money. And this dude's willing to do it just to have this guy wear an Indian headdress and dance around like a fool. I told my wife that, you know, if this whole law thing doesn't work out for me, this could be a fairly good fallback position, you know, be the gringo witch doctor in our community. She quickly shut that down and didn't see the humor in it. But, you know, I figured I could act like a fool and only charge half of what that guy did and probably get just as good results, right? All right, so back to the star of our show this week, Mona. She leaves the world of entertainment to become a spiritual advisor whose wisdom comes from, I guess, witchcraft. A witchy wise woman. I believe she was known as a Bomo or a Boma. I saw it spelled two different ways, which apparently translates into English as a shaman. And so, you know, Mona makes this career change and for whatever reason just hits the lottery. She found a gold mine. She just instantly was rolling in dough, which I totally believe because Javier, the construction worker, would pay $25,000 for a guy's services. I can only imagine what this woman was charging. You know, she had a knack of attracting really high profile clients, particularly in the political world. So people that were wanting to run for office for the first time or were wanting to move up to a new position or were just trying to protect their current position would come see her. And they would pay a lot of money for Mona's services, which meant, you know, kind of like I said, Mona and Muhammad became extremely wealthy almost overnight. Within, I think it was 3 years, they were, you know, traveling in the top social circles of Malaysia. They owned several mansions. They bought a yacht. They had a whole fleet of luxury cars. And basically all she did was offer blessings and cleansings and sold talismans and enchanted special items and did things like that. And she developed this reputation somehow by being this guru who could make and break careers. And, you know, like I said, within 3 years, she's essentially a superstar, just in a different field. So in 1993, Mona takes on this new client by the name of Maslan Idris, who was a rising star in Malaysian politics. He was preparing to make a play at a chief minister position, and he wanted Mona and her magical powers behind his campaign, I reckon. My understanding of the Malaysian system is that the chief minister is kind of sort of like what we would call a governor in the United States. He's kind of the head of state for a state. And, you know, it's kind of weird when I looked into it. Malaysia has 13 states. 9 of these chief minister positions are hereditary. And the other 4 are elected by the state's assembly. So he's going for one of the elected positions. Because if it was hereditary, he wouldn't need Mona's services. He would just, you know, be born into that position. So Mona, out of the kindness of her heart, agrees to help Maslan. Kindness of the heart. I mean, you know, she charged 2.5 million rignings, or, you know, in American dollars, that's about 600,000. It worked 1.2 million pesos, if you're in Mexico listening, 110,000 euros, or one jade monkey. You know, that's all in today's money. I didn't bother to do the exchange rate for back in the early 90s. But, you know, that's apparently what it costs to get the entities of bad juju on your side. You know, and here I am thinking that $25,000 is absurd when she's charging significantly more than that. But, you know, she's affecting politics, not just love. So Maslin paid $500,000 of his bill in cash. And then there's kind of conflicting information here. He either paid the other $2 million via 10 property deeds, or he kind of went on an installment plan and used those 10 pieces of property as security. Little unclear on that detail, but regardless, we know that they entered into a written agreement, and we know that at least deeds were made out to Mona's name for this land. So Mona said, cool, awesome, love the money. Come over to one of my mansions, and I have a gift for you. Plus, we'll, you know, do the first cleansing ritual. So this gift was, it's described in the articles as a cane owned by the former president of Indonesia. And she had allegedly enchanted it to make the owner, quote, invincible. I mean, it's not like Maslin's going into battle. I don't know why he needs to be invincible, but I mean, that if somebody offered me a cane that would keep me from dying, I guess I'd take it too, especially after I gave him all that money. So then they start the cleansing ritual. Okay. So what, you know, and I kind of take issue with that description of what occurred, but regardless, here we go. So Mona has Maslin lay down. I don't know if it was on the ground or on the bed. I hope for the price he got, it was a very, very comfortable bed. And she had him close his eyes, and she started kind of doing this, I guess, guided meditation, where she's telling him to imagine money just falling from the sky and landing on him. And as she was doing this, she was going around him and putting flowers and flower petals on him. You know, just slowly walking around, covering him in flowers, doing this meditation. It's just a very nice, relaxing scene. And he was chilling out, you know, the muscles were unclenching. He was getting down with it when Mona's assistant came in to help and, chopped his head off with an axe. Yeah, kind of out of left field there, huh? Three chops and his head was completely severed from Maslin's body. And that was the end of the ritual. So that's kind of why I take issue with it being called a cleansing ritual. I would call it more like a murder ritual. But, you know, I'm not a witch doctor, so I wouldn't understand such things, I reckon. So after his head was cleansed from his body, Mona, her husband, and her assistant then decided they needed to do something about this body. Chopped it up into 18 pieces. For some reason, several pieces were skinned. That was never explained, and honestly, I didn't dig deep into that. I just assumed she needed the skin for something. Then they take those 18 body parts out to a storehouse she owned that was on her property and buried them in either one big hole or 18 small holes. Again, conflicting information. But regardless, Maslin ends up in the dirt. And, you know, what's weird is all 18 pieces were never found. And that led to many locals claiming that these three were cannibals. And, you know, one thing I should have to point out, it's unclear to me if Maslin had the cane when the beheading occurred, because if he did, I think I'd want my money back for the cane, because he was not invincible, obviously. Okay, so you're Malaysia's top spiritual guru. You've just committed this random and bizarre murder for no reason. What do you do with yourself? Well, apparently the correct answer is you go on a shopping spree. Yeah, seriously. Mona took her money that she hadn't paid and had a treat yourself kind of day. She bought a new Mercedes. She picked out a lot of new outfits and clothing. The witch even went and got a facelift. All financed by the money that Maslin had paid to apparently be murdered. Now, amazingly, shockingly, and somewhat disturbingly, no one noticed that Maslin was missing for a few weeks at least. And really, the investigation only began because police and others kind of thought that Maslon may be up to no good. You know, on paper, all they see is that he'd withdrawn a ton of money from the bank and then just kind of disappeared and missed, like, several important government functions. So because police were investigating this matter as a missing person situation, they didn't make any progress in learning what happened to Maslon. They either made very little or no progress, depending on who you talk to and which articles you read. But it's clear they had no leads or direction. And, you know, there were very strong rumors that this investigation came to a dead end very quickly. Now, despite apparently having all these amazing contacts in the spiritual world, I guess you'd say, Mona was kind of undone by a twist of fate. See, her assistant used his cut of the earnings to just get totally smashed. He was high out of his mind. And, you know, he was to that point where he was so high that he didn't care about the dangers of buying more drugs. And, you know, kind of got caught in a wide open transaction and was arrested. Well, he was so out of his mind when police brought him in that he knew he was being arrested for Maslon's murder. And so I don't know if this is how it played out, but I like to imagine that they, you know, put him in an American style interrogation room, which they probably don't have. A detective walks in and he says, "Yeah, I killed him. I know where his body is." And the detective's like, "Okay, what?" So, the assistant basically says, "Look, I know, you know, I can take you to where Maslon's body is. I helped kill him when he came over to Mona's house." And when he mentioned Mona, then police ears really perked up. They were very intrigued. They really wanted to investigate this, but they also knew that they had to be really careful because they couldn't just haphazardly arrest someone with Mona's political connections and her magical connections too, I guess. So they had the assistant take him to the storehouse. Now, coincidentally, huge coincidence, massive coincidence, after the threesome did their little burial ritual, it just so happened that Mona decided that the storehouse really should have a proper concrete floor rather than some ratty old dirt floor that, say, you know, the police could dig into whenever they wanted. So police do their thing, eventually get permission to break the concrete, dig around in the ground. And like I said, they find most of Maslon's body buried about 5.5 feet or 1.8 meters under the concrete floor. Based on this evidence and based on the assistant's testimony, Mona and her husband were arrested pretty soon thereafter. So Mona, her husband, and her assistant are all charged with, I guess, the Malaysian equivalent of capital murder. Except that in Malaysia, unlike in the United States, if you're found guilty, the death sentence is mandatory. You know, where here it's kind of discretionary. So, you know, Malaysians don't mess around with their definition of punishment. So they're arrested in 93 and 95. Mona and her mates appear before a 7-person jury for trial. And the trial was, as you probably can imagine, just this total circus. And Mona's at the center of it, acting just like a totally crazy person. She showed up to court each day smiling, wearing all these flashy designer clothing, and acting like this was some sort of concert she had been waiting for her entire life. Entering and leaving the courthouse every day, she would like stop and pose for photographers like she was on some sort of Hollywood red carpet, you know. And she made comments to police and her attorneys and things that she was impressed with how many fans she had. She clearly was in her own world or wanted people to believe that. This trial somehow lasted 65 days. That's, you know, 13 work weeks or a quarter of a year. And this is, they found a dead dude on her land with her assistant saying, yeah, we killed him. You know, I never had a criminal trial last more than 5 days. I don't know how you make it go on for 65. But apparently there were somewhere around 76 or so witnesses who testified at trial. And almost 300 exhibits were entered into evidence. And, you know, again, we've got a body and we've got a confession. So it seems like massive overkill, but I don't know the Malaysian legal system that well. And during these 65 days, Mona just rolled in the attention like a pig in slop. She loved it. She smiled during most of the hearings. Like, even when they're spelling out the details of Maslon's horrible, horrible death, she's smiling and enjoying it. You know, like she's at some career achievement award in her honor. Imagine the prosecutor sitting there, they chopped him up and then they skinned him, and she's just sitting over there smiling. I mean, that total lack of humanity just kind of makes my spine shiver. Since this was a circus, naturally, this was the headline on the news every night. It's, you know, like the O.J. Simpson trial of Malaysia, if you were alive during that fiasco. The country was totally obsessed with this trial. It was the topic of office gossip every day. And, you know, for good reason, when you think about what a wild crime this was, when you have a witch doctor murdering a politician and then chopping it, it's just weird. And then you have the mastermind sitting there in trial with this creepy, inhumane smile on her face. Now, the prosecutor argued the motive for the murder was revenge for a land deal gone bad. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know that you really need a motive when you've got a dead body. But regardless, you know, after the 13 weeks of trial, the jury unanimously found all three guilty. The jurors only deliberated for 70 minutes before reaching a verdict. Now, when the judge read the verdict, Mona, of course, has to be creepy and scary. And her comment to the press was, "I'm happy and I thank you all, Malaysians." She's being led to prison by, you know, armed police, and she smiled for the cameras and waved and just soaked up all the attention. Naturally, Mona and her crew filed an appeal, which was ultimately rejected in 1999. She also sought a special pardon from the Pardons Board, but that was rejected. And the date of the threesome's execution was set for November 2nd, 2001. On November 1st, they were allowed to meet with their family for the last time, and they were served a special dinner of KFC. I don't know why I like that little detail, but it cracks me up. And, you know, honestly, that's better than what, at least in Alabama, prisoners get for their last meal. On the morning of November 2nd, the threesome were led to the prison gallows and hanged. Time of death, 5:59 a.m. Mona died at the age of 45. Prison officials claim that none of the three ever expressed any remorse or asked for forgiveness for their crimes. Okay, now some prison officials who made these reports anonymously, of course, claims that there were odd things that would happen around Mona's cell in the weeks leading up to her execution. They never really defined what strange things were, but it was enough that it bothered them. Nobody liked going by her cell. And there's some, both prison officials and civilians, who claimed to have seen Mona out on November 1st at a bar enjoying one last drink. You know, nobody would ever go on record corroborating this, but, you know, she apparently used her magical powers to escape just to enjoy one last drink. Not to get away and live, but to have a nightcap. So, as you can imagine, during the entire hanging ceremony, Mona's got this creepy smile plastered on her face. When she was on the gallows about to die, she gave her last words, which were, "Aku takkan mati." And apparently in English that means, "I will never die." Holy God, that's creepy. So Mona seemingly, you know, yearned to be an entertainer since an early age, and to quote Kurt Vonnegut, One of the few good things about modern times, if you die horribly on television, you will not have died in vain. You will have entertained us. So in her own way, Mona did entertain. Now, this trial had like massive lasting repercussions for the country because it was such a case and because it was like this frenzied obsession that just grabbed hold of the populace and wouldn't let go. Malaysian lawmakers decided, you know what? Maybe we ought to eliminate this whole jury trial system. So that's one of Mona's lasting charms on this earth, is if you are now facing criminal charges in Malaysia, you don't get a jury trial. This case was kind of also quickly adopted into the Malaysian collective consciousness. Obviously it's such an amazingly gruesome murder, but then all the gossip and rumors and everything about it, you know, television specials were made, movies were made, and it's everybody knows about it. And it seems like the most popular movie about this case is called Dukun, D-U-K-U-N. I didn't really try to find a copy of it, and I don't know if you can get it in English or what the deal is. But if you want to look it up and send me a review, that'd be awesome. Now, of course, in today's world, MoMA's former mansions are now just hotspots for alleged hauntings. I think only two of her mansions are still standing. They're left abandoned. And, of course, teenagers often break into the house, you know, to look for evidence of black magic or for ghostly apparitions or what have you. You know, the typical teenage dare stuff. Those who have managed to successfully break in and explore swear they have seen stuff. They can't really explain what it is. You know, it's generally the house has dark energy, or I saw spirits roaming the hallways. Nothing very specific. Now, the one part of Mona that I like, if this is true, and of course you have to take this with a grain of salt, but let's pretend like it's true just for funsies, okay? A few people have claimed to see Mona alive and well at her favorite nightclubs, dancing the night away. So, you know, she comes back as a ghost. No, she doesn't haunt her mansion or do anything creepy. She just wants to party. How about that? I mean, yeah, she's creepy and evil, but she just wants to have fun in her afterlife, I guess. More power to her on that end. She should have done more of that and less witchcraft and beheading, and I think she would have had a better life. Now, COVID has made Mona a folk hero. All right. I know you hear that and you're thinking, Brad, you cannot possibly connect her death in 2001 with a pandemic beginning in 2020, but I can and I will. The citizens of Malaysia have become so frustrated with their government's terrible response to the COVID epidemic. And they're so tired of hearing stories about politicians using their positions to receive vaccines for themselves and their families and their supporters before the general public can have access to vaccines, and just in general, the corruption that seems to exist within the government, that Mona has actually been trending on Twitter multiple times, claiming that she was kind of a hero before her time and that there needs to be a way to resurrect her so she can take out more politicians. You know, and that's, of course, now led to people feeling sympathy for Mona, saying she was punished unjustly. And, you know, their argument kind of makes sense that, look, these politicians are like asking for the help of evil spirits to move up in the world. And they're coming to Mona for that. So they're the bad guys here. You know, they're consorting with whatever Mona consorts with. And so they're just as bad as she is. In fairness, they didn't behead anyone, but I guess I kind of see the, no, I don't, but I can follow the logic even if I don't agree with it. So I'm gonna try my best to analyze this case, but you know, please remember I don't know nothing about the Malaysian criminal justice system. I know that will shock many of you, but it just wasn't a required course in my law school. So this is just my best effort at providing some hopefully decent logical thoughts. Now, the first thing that needs to be mentioned that I learned for my research is that Malaysian culture still places a lot of faith in the world of magic. I mean, obviously, you know, witch doctors and talismans and things like that, that we kind of look at askance, they really just adopt and accept. It's really considered normal for politicians to seek help from spiritual gurus during the course of their career. And that's true for business leaders, a lot of entertainment icons, basically all manner of folks who are looking for, all manner of folks who are looking for some form of success. They will go to a spiritual guru of some sort, be it a witch doctor or a shaman or, you know, a new ager or what have you, just whatever their persuasion is. And that's a cultural aspect that we kind of have to keep in mind, as we review this case. I'll begin, you know, my analysis by saying this is probably one of the worst planned murders we've ever covered on this podcast. Mona really did nothing to try to cover her tracks or her relationship with Maslon. You know, she was known for being connected to a lot of politicians. Maslon was known for wanting to climb the political ladder. They had a written agreement. It involved 10 different pieces of land Maslon owned. I assume the agreement also included her total bill somewhere in there. You know, the murder was committed in Mona's own house. Maslon was buried on her property. And yet the police struggled to find a connection between those two. You know, if it wasn't for her dopehead assistant, it's really possible that Mona never gets arrested. And it's possible that the police never considered Maslon anything other than a missing person. He may have just been written off as somebody who moved on to another country and greener pastures for whatever reason. And, you know, that's kind of what I would call crazy bad investigating. But I really am curious what Mona's plan was here. I mean, just rely on political connections for help? Did she have some sort of invisibility cloak she was going to use to sneak away? I mean, it's just an asinine plan that, frankly, almost worked. Let me invite a dude over and kill him and then bury him and just do nothing about it. I'm also kind of shocked that the assistant got a death sentence. You know, I confirmed he was represented by counsel during the trial and other proceedings. And, you know, of course, I'm just sitting here saying, why would the attorney allow his client to testify about the murder when all it will do is seal his client's death? I don't know Malaysian rules. I don't know Malaysian criminal procedure. I have to assume from this that there are limited or no self-incrimination protections in Malaysia, because the police never would have cracked this case without the assistant's help. And I'm surprised that didn't give him extra consideration by the police or the court for his assistance. But, you know, when you chop up a politician's body, maybe you don't deserve too much leniency. And I'm surprised, too, at how far the prosecution went in presenting evidence in this case. I cannot imagine forcing a jury to sit in a jury box for 13 weeks and listen to over 70 witnesses and review almost 300 pieces of evidence when this case can be broken down into almost nothing. I mean, I would say with a fair amount of confidence, in the United States at least, again, I don't understand the Malaysian legal system, but in the United States, I could present this case to a jury in a day, maybe a day and a half, and be 99.9% certain of obtaining a conviction. You know, I'd want to show the jury that the body was found on Mona's land. Mona had the burial location covered in concrete. The assistant confessed to participating in the murder under Mona's instructions, and show the jury the agreement concerning the 10 pieces of real estate. You know, that way you start off by hitting the jury with the most shocking evidence first, then you tie Mona to the case with the burial location, the cement floor, and the assistant's testimony, and you demonstrate Mona was working with Maslon and had this payment agreement in place. You also, I would probably put on some evidence about her spending spree just to show her total lack of remorse. Now, on the other side, I don't know how much I could do. Defending Mono would be tough. I think we'd have to take the approach of painting the assistant as very greedy, a cokehead who had an irrational grudge and committed this murder and tried to pin it on Mona. You know, I'd try to spin the spending spree as the actions of someone who wasn't carrying any guilt or stress from a murder. It was just a typical day in a wealthy woman's life. I'd also want to show that Bazelon paid Mona, you know, a good bit of money, but she was owed a ton more. And so what incentive would she have to kill Maslon? She'd want to keep him alive to get that extra $2 million she was still owed. $2 million. And I'd get other politicians Mona had worked with to testify that, you know, yeah, she routinely performed these services. They hadn't had any problems with her. They had never heard of any disputes between her and Maslon. You know, off the top of my head, that's the best I could do to create some degree of reasonable doubt in the jury's mind. I don't think they could get over the images of the dead body being buried on her property. It's not a case I'd want to have to try, but that's probably the best shot I could give it. And at this point, I just want to say, even though it's really not neither here nor there, as I've hinted at, this woman looks creepy. I am totally inclined to believe she's down with some spooky stuff. And not, you know, in the cute goth way teenagers claim to be. You know, if you can sell your soul, I bet she's tried to do it, and she's probably tried to do it multiple times. The old creepypasta, Jeff the Killer, if you've seen that, if not, look it up. She has that vibe to her. She looks like Jeff the Killer's mother. So, all right, well, time to end our tale of witchy murder. Mona is kind of super evil, in my opinion, and got what she deserved. It's terrible what she did. But, you know, part of the reason why you don't trust witch doctors, either they murder you or they steal your murder or money and not get your girl back. It's hard to find someone worse than lawyers, but there you go. Okay, joke time. Now, I gave Mr. Eli the week off. I figured for an episode on witchcraft, he didn't really need to be involved in it. So, you know, since I handled the joke picking duties this week, if you want to switch over to another podcast right now, I won't blame you at all. And frankly, I picked one that's probably too immature for Eli, you know, who's still in elementary school. So that's saying something, but here we go. All right. I liked this one, which says more about me than the joke, probably. What is the difference between an oral thermometer and a rectal thermometer? Think about it. The difference between an oral thermometer and a rectal thermometer. Well, I would say the taste, mostly. The taste would be the biggest difference. Thus concludes another tale in these continuing adventures of the Killin' Missin' Hidden podcast. Come back next week for more thrills and chills. I'll give you a little preview. We're staying in Malaysia next week, I believe. If you want even more contact. No, I know you don't want contact with me. If you want any more content, then you know all about our Patreon that you can join. You should join. We also have tons of cool merchandise that you can invest in at kmhpodcast.com. We've added a bucket hat. That's exciting, right? Don't you want a bucket hat? You'd look good in a bucket hat. I'd buy a bucket hat if I were you. Biggest thing you can do for us that doesn't cost a thing is leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. If you want to throw in a nice review too, that's awesome. But we're at like 193 reviews or something like that as I write this. So if we could crack 200, that'd be kick butt. And, you know, we, of course, love it when you share our work with others. So please do what you can to annoy your friends and neighbors. And what a great, great way to do it. I mean, I'm always looking for ways to annoy my friends. And so, you know, rather than joining some sort of pyramid scheme, I think I'd just push podcasts on them. Thank you for joining us. We love having you come visit and hope to see you again next week. Otherwise, it's just me talking to myself and my life is weird enough as is. I want to give a quick shout out to the Strange Sessions podcast. We've worked with them before on some stuff, but they deserve to be celebrated as they are releasing their 100th episode this week. So congrats to them. Props to them. one of my favorite podcasts just because Kurt and Chris are so huggable. So go check them out if you can. But everyone listening, have an awesome week. Do something kind, either for yourself or someone else. Brad out.
Thank you for listening to Killin, Missin, Hidden. Make sure to rate, subscribe, and share. Questions? Email us at info@kmhpodcast.com.